This show is part of the Head Stuff Podcast Network.
This podcast is proudly sponsored by HappyTummy.ie, the exclusive distributor of BioGaia probiotics in Ireland. Discover BioGaia Gastrus, a clinically proven probiotic for a balanced gut and improved well-being. BioGaia's probiotics, featuring Lactobacillus reuteri, are renowned for their trustworthiness and effectiveness. With origins dating back to the dawn of humanity, these probiotics are scientifically proven to support your entire gastrointestinal tract. And here's some great news for our Baby Tribe listeners. Enjoy a 10% discount on all BioGaia products at happytummy.ie by using the code BABYTRIBE10 at checkout. Invest in your gut health today with happytummy.ie and BioGaia. Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Baby Tribe podcast. Katie, I'm really looking forward to spring. We're in the throes, I think, of a holiday pandemic, aren't we? Like, we've just come out of the February midterm, and the Easter two-week holiday is just around the corner.
Yes. And like, let's be honest, guys, I'm sure there's other parents out there that are struggling with juggling childcare, organizing work, and managing the kids at home. And now we're going into Easter and we're trying to go, oh my God, how am I going to cope? I'm not going to lie to you guys. We bring in a little bit more screen time during these times for us to, for myself and Jim to manage. Don't know about you, Afif. In fairness, your kids are a bit bigger, but the iPad does help us. And it's the only way we can function. But that leads us into a really good...
Yeah, so we are going to talk about screens. And please don't switch off and don't hate me for saying what I'm about to say. But I, just like all of you, am a parent as well. And I remember thinking, with our first child, we were pretty good about the no screen rule up until she was about 18 months. You know, we did plonk her in front of the TV every now and again, but we were very conscious of, you know, engaging with her and doing this and doing that. But myself and Anne went to Toronto with an 18-month-old child to both do very busy fellowships to complete our training. You know, she was in creche during the day. In the evenings, we a lot of the time used to catch up on work and things like that. So screen time kept going up and up and up and up. And then Faisal came during our busy time in Toronto. Yeah, out of the blue. With the second child, it's really hard to isolate them from screens when the first child is into the throes of it. And I used to remember that when the iPad first came out, it was in and around that time and we were all fascinated by the thing, including my child. And Maggie became a whiz at it from the very outset. And he could see Faisal when he began to crawl and walk that he'd kind of slowly edge his way towards his sister and literally yank it from her arms. And the fights, oh my God, the fights that they used to have. But I remember thinking that we may have a problem when I gave Faisal a book, just a normal book, and he put two fingers on the screen and on the page, sorry, and did the, you know, this kind of movement that you do to zoom in.
Yeah.
So he wanted to zoom in onto the picture on the paper and he kept doing it and it wouldn't work. And he got really pissed off and I was like, okay, we might need
something
to,
wrong with this. Do you know what? That's so true though, even by what you say, like on our first Luke and even Lily, there was only 18 months between them and they were very young. So we would have probably... they probably got a lot more play time and, you know, they would have played together a lot and they did have screen time. I'm not going to lie, but probably not as much. By our fourth, Jack, during COVID, because everyone worked from home, we had no childcare, things changed completely. I would say, honestly, and I'm not going to lie, the TV helped us in so many ways and screens. But if you gave a phone to a kid now, they actually do exactly what you say. They're able to enlarge and everything else. They can use them nearly more effective than the parent can. Whereas if you gave them an old camera, guaranteed, or an old phone, they don't know how to work it at all.
I remember Faisal asking me, Dad, when did iPads change from being black and white to color?
And
I'm going, dude, there was no iPads back then. But Maggie actually said something really, really funny. She said to us, and she was only 4 or 5, and she looks at us and goes, guys, when did the world become colorful? Oh. And we were like, what? And it was like, wasn't the world black and white up until recently? And then it became colorful. Because when you see TV in the olden days, it was black and white. So when did the world become colorful? So she actually thought that we were all black and white. And then all of a sudden something happened, something magical happened, that color was introduced, which is such a cute thing to think. And yeah, she was disappointed to kind of learn the truth that it was always colorful. It was just the TVs didn't have the technology to display color.
So what we're going to talk about today about, I suppose, the new era of digital that we all find ourselves in. Myself and Afif are still coming from a parenting background, and we are putting our hands up there and say we do use screens. We've overused them at times. I can definitely say I have, and I'm sure Afif will agree. But we're going to do a little bit of, Afif is going to talk a little bit about a paper he has found and some research. And we're just going to talk about it in a general term and, you know, discuss it.
We're going to put it in context.
Yeah.
And what I found really interesting about the paper is not what it has shown, which I'm sure a lot of you will predict what the paper has shown, but just a little bit of some intricacies that I thought would be interesting in a parenting sense. We all know now that screen time, the more screen time a child does, especially in their early years, and we're talking 12 months, 18 months, 24 months, the more screen time they do, the less likely that they are doing other things that help promote their social development. The other really intriguing thing about the brain of a young child is that it still displays what is called neuroplasticity. And what that is that you can actually rewire the brain based on what you do, which is quite intriguing, quite interesting, might sound scary in one sense, but in another sense means that, for example, if you change the connectivity within the brain because of excessive screen time, you could still rein it in and rewire the brain by being mindful of the duration of screen time. And there are studies that show that certain behavioral changes that result from excessive screen time can be mitigated and reversed if you reduce screen time. So I found that.
That's a pretty interesting thing. So
yeah,
like just because maybe you've used them excessively, it's sometimes we can still pull back.
Yeah. And what this study focused on is what is called sensory processing, what it refers to as atypical sensory processing.
So now, before we go any further, Afif, please explain to our listeners exactly what that is.
Atypical sensory processing refers to the way some children process sensory input. So what am I talking about? They process, you know, things that they hear, things that they see, things that they touch, things that they taste, and so on and so forth. So all their sensory inputs that comes into their system, there are typical ways to respond to these. And it can be hard to sort of articulate what that typical way is. And I'll elaborate on that in a little bit. But what atypical sensory behavior or processing refers to is that they react to sensory input in a different way. So they may overreact to certain textures or sounds. They may not be reacting to, for example, ignoring being called in all the time. And I'm sure a lot of us can relate to that. Some of our children have selective hearing and will only respond if they feel like it.
Sorry, just on that, just a really quick funny story. Jim, actually, one of our kids was going for the school hearing, and Jim actually, I didn't know it had come in, the HSE form, and Jim wrote on it, I feel that there is an issue because they don't respond. And they actually phoned Jim later after it and said, your child has absolutely nothing wrong. It's called selective hearing. So, you know, there you go.
So, and what I found also interesting is the link between those atypical sensory processing things and developmental outcomes down the line. Now, what I'm about to say may sound scary, but I don't want people to be scared. They relate atypical sensory processing to an increased likelihood of developing ADHD and also disorders that fall within the autism spectrum, right? But that does not mean that kids that display atypical sensory behavior early on are destined to get those. It's just babies with ADHD and ASD are more likely to have atypical sensory behaviors, if that makes sense. And the exposure that they looked at in the study is screen time. So they looked at screen time as yes or no happening at 12 months of age. And then they looked at screen time in a more sort of accumulative way at 18 months and at 24 months. So they looked at three time points, whether babies were exposed to screens at 12 months and whether then they were exposed to screens at 18 and 24 months and the duration per day. And this was all done by parental questionnaires. The parents were also asked to fill out something called the infant toddler sensory profile. So again, it was a questionnaire looking at infant behaviors and how they respond to things. And they looked at four main domains, right? And they divide them based on something called the Dunn's model of sensory processing. And I'm going to label those four and describe what they sort of mean. And I'm sure a lot of parents are going to relate to some or all of these things. So just to emphasize that these ways of behavior can be quite common in children anyway. So the first one they talk about, Katie, is low registration. So that's a child who fails to notice obvious stimuli in an environment and may be slow to respond. So what Jim was concerned about, pretty much, you know?
Yes.
The second one is sensation seeking. So this is a child who actively seeks sensory stimuli throughout the day, such as excessive touching or smelling objects or repetitively spinning items while staring at them. Again, a lot of people may associate these behaviors with being concerning, but a lot of children
will do them.
Will do them as well. And I'm sure you see that in your daily practice, Katie. The third one is sensory sensitivity. So that's a child who is overly irritated or upset by lights or certain textures or noises. And that really resonates with me in that my son used to hate the tags coming out of clothes.
Or the ribs on socks.
Or the ribs on socks. So this is what this is talking about. So again, a lot of children do display these things. And then finally is sensation avoiding. So this is a child who actively tries to control the environment to limit sensory exposure, resisting having hair brushed, hair washed, and things like that. So again, a lot of the time,
these are normal.
These are normal and they happen in a lot of children. What the study has shown basically is that the more screen time,
the more these are heightened.
The more these are heightened. So the more screen time you get at 12 months, 18 months, and 24 months, the more likely you are going to be displaying some of those behaviors at around 33 months of age. So that's as far as they went in terms of looking at it.
We are taking a quick pause to cross-promote another amazing podcast from the Head Stuff Network. Afif, who are we showcasing this week?
Ah, Katie, this is a special one and one of my favorite newly launched podcasts out there. Deirdre O'Kane and Emma Doran have teamed up to launch a new podcast called Keep It Tight, where they discuss what's delighted them, what's bewildered them, what's enraged them, and everything in between. No topic is out of bounds, from the highest brow to the lowest pelvic floor. Let's have a quick listen.
So Gwyneth Paltrow's a pain in the hole. Is that agreed?
I think that's the national consensus on Gwyneth, that she's a melt, she's a pain in the hole.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Well, if you're listening and you're interested in who else is a pain in the hole, we have a list.
Oh, we have a list and it's extensive and it's growing.
Pains in the hole and the ticks. We have a list of ticks.
Yeah. And we'll get into it. And if you don't agree with us, that means that you could be in the list. So you might as well listen.
Yeah. To make sure you're not on the list of ticks.
Yeah.
Or pains in the hole. Somebody used to call me Deirdre O'Pain in the hole.
But you're definitely not a pain in the hole.
I'm not. God, no. Okay. But I am doing a podcast called Keep It Tight with Emma Dorn.
We're here, myself and the queen of comedy, Deirdre O'Kane. We're keeping it tight every week on a Wednesday. Get involved or you'll be on the list.
Yeah, you think.
But when you actually look at dividing children into those that watch TV versus those that didn't watch TV, there is a huge overlap in those symptoms, meaning that the differences are quite small between the two. The authors did try to adjust for certain factors, and we spoke about that last week, you know, adjusting for factors that may also influence outcome. And they adjusted for the child's age, the child's sex, race and ethnicity, parent education, parent income, prematurity at birth, and you know, whether the child was playing with toys at 12 months daily versus less than daily, and caregivers taking a walk with the child at 12 months. So they did try and adjust for other factors that may positively or negatively influence those things. And again, the changes were even further mitigated.
Yeah.
Okay. And what that shows, and I think what we're trying to get at, is screen time is just one aspect of influencing development. So if you plonk your child in front of a TV for 12 hours a day, of course, they're going to have these issues down the line. But if you even do
balance it,
2 hours, 3 hours, even 4 hours sometimes, but make a point of spending quality time with them, engaging them in play, engaging them in interactions at other times, then I really think that those atypical behavioral processing patterns that I've just described will be balanced out.
Fully agree. And I think, like, I would often go in, and especially like the first child, it's a little bit easier. They get a lot of, you know, individual play, a lot of individual attention. But once you have more kids, And we always know when the second comes into play, things can be really difficult for parents. And I go, look, you have to do what you can do in the grand scheme of things. So if there's times where everyone's having a bit of a meltdown, you sit down in front of that TV, you have to put it in the context. That's not going to lead to all these issues long term. But when they have significant play, they've got development, they've got good interaction with parents and other kids alike, then this isn't going, like, screen time, 1, 2, 3 hours is not going to have a drastic negative impact. But the child that is sitting for long periods with no interaction, no verbal communication, and all these other, I suppose, social circumstances come into play, then this is what can lead where you're more likely to see these symptoms heightened.
And, you know, the other interesting thing that the paper has raised, and it's something that I think we should touch on, children with a propensity, genetically or otherwise, to develop those atypical sensory behaviors may be the children that are more likely to be drawn to the screen. So which is the chicken, which is the egg, you know? So some child that may have those issues that are still under the surface are more likely maybe to want to sit in front of a screen for longer. So it's not really that the screen is causing those behaviors, is that those indolent behaviors that are about to come out are causing the increased screen time. And that's something that's sometimes hard to decipher or distinguish, because when we talk about temporality, in order for something to cause another, it must occur before the outcome, if you know what I mean. But sometimes that is not clear from the studies, right? Is it the abnormal behavior or the unusual behavior that lead to increased screen time, or is it the other way around? So that's something to be mindful of.
And I suppose, like what myself and Afif have both said, in clinical practice and just in when we look at our own kids, a lot of these behaviours we spoke about are quite normal parts of development. We'd see a lot of kids do it. That does not lead them to have issues later on.
Yes, and the paper is very clear to point out that these behaviours does not automatically mean that a child's going to develop behavioural issues down the line. And they do say that. And what they say exactly, and I'll quote, while atypical sensory processing can occur among typically developing children, it is more prevalent among children with ADHD and ASD. So that's exactly what we're saying.
Yeah.
I mean, they do occur amongst children that have no issues with behavior and development down the line. I'm sure a lot of parents are riddled with guilt, and I just want to tell them a story to reassure them, because oftentimes when they see a healthcare advocate doing exactly what parents are doing, they always get comfortable. My wife always gives that to me. There's this photograph of me sitting playing Xbox with Maggie when she was about 3 years of age, sitting right beside me engrossed in an iPad and me to keep my 1.5-year-old other child quiet, I handed him another controller without the batteries on my lap, watching the screen, watching me play as well. So
so just to be clear now, Afif, if you didn't know, is a complete gamer.
Yeah,
like absolutely. I was so taken back. I just wasn't expecting it when I walked in to his house and I saw all this equipment. I was like, oh my God, what's going on? So he's a tech nerd as well, guys.
I'd like to blame it all on Faisal, but...
No, you started. I think you created...
I created Faisal.
Yeah.
Well, I did, but...
Whereas myself and Jim, we're not really techie. Like, although Jim works in IT, we're not big into gamer. Like Luke, I think, would love to live with Afif because he'd be so delighted to be able to play that PlayStation when he wants. And we're kind of a little bit stricter. But like, look, we're coming into an era where digital is going to be the way, like for nearly every platform. When they're in school, it's all digital, how they communicate, as in with regards to their homework and all that kind of stuff. So I suppose we have to be open and we have to be aware of it. But I suppose it's just when we look at the age of the child.
Yeah. And speaking about how children communicate differently now, and we'll touch on that in other episodes as well.
They talk through text.
Oh, I wish it was talking through text. So my son Faisal got a VR virtual reality headset for Christmas.
Oh, right? Mine really wanted this.
Yeah, so you can play virtual reality games, and I'm sure a lot of people now understand what that is. But for those who don't, you basically put on these massive goggles over your face. They cover your entire visual field and they immerse you in a three-dimensional virtual world. So you're literally transported somewhere else. That's not the scary bit. The scary bit is his VR equipment do augmented reality. So what it does, what they do is, rather than immersing you in a completely virtual world, it adds virtual element to the real environment in front of you. So he can now sit down on a table and be looking at that table through his VR headset, but the VR would add a Lego world and put it on top of the table that he can interact with, walk around. So it's like...
Oh my God, that is crazy.
It is. So he can now build a Lego set
without actually building it.
But the characters will walk. They'll actually go in and out of the houses, and he can peek in and out of the houses. He can open the little doors and windows and look inside, and he can walk around it. And it's as if it's actually sitting on the table.
I was just about to say, I guarantee Afifa spent hours at this.
I can neither confirm nor deny that. The scary bit is if one of his mates has the same VR headset, it will put his mate on the other side of the table.
Oh, wow.
So they can now chat to each other as if they are sitting across the room from each other while the other kid is anywhere across the world. So he has another friend that has the same headset. And I came and he was sitting at the table just chatting to an empty chair. And I was like, have you lost your mind, Faz? No, I'm chatting to Sammy. He's just sitting here across the table. Like, no, he's not. Like, yes, he is, Dad.
So, oh my God.
Isn't that crazy?
So guys, look, all we can say is you can see how Afif overexposed his kids and they're all doing very well.
Well, it's debatable, but that's yet to be decided.
So let's be honest, it all comes down to parenting. It's like the holistic approach and making sure socially, emotionally and physically their needs are all met is what we're talking about today.
Absolutely. So Katie, let's pause for a moment to remind our listeners that Baby Tribe is now part of the Head Stuff Podcast Network, and we are now in a position to offer our listeners bonus content via Head Stuff Plus.
That's right, Afif, our spin-off series, Keeping Up with the Kafashians, hosted by you and your lovely wife, Anne Doherty, treats our listeners to the fabulous husband and wife discussions, an expansion of points raised here on the Baby Tribe, and some science as well.
So please subscribe for as little as €5 per month and make sure to select Baby Tribe and Keeping Up with the Kafashians as your podcast to support. Subscribing will give you access to all the bonus content on Head Stuff Plus. And guys, Katie's weekly appearance fees are getting a bit much for me, so we'd really value your support.
I wish everyone. Afif's skincare routine is ridiculous. You should see the potions and lotions he uses every single day.
Listen, it takes a lot to look this good. Thank you to everyone who have subscribed so far. And if you haven't subscribed yet, why the hell not? And we are now going to move on to our guest. And our guest for this episode is pretty incredible. Her name is Dr. Trish Scanlon, and she is a close friend of mine that I have known for a very, very long time. We trained together in Ireland, and then our paths have sort of diverged a little bit, and we've sort of met up again a while ago, and I said, I have to get you back and chat to us on the Baby Tribe, and I'll tell you why. So Dr. Trish Scanlon is actually a pediatric oncologist. She has moved to Tanzania. So she's a pediatric oncologist at Muhimbili National Hospital, and she serves as the CEO of their National Childhood Cancer Charity and their Lives Matter group, and holds the role of Interim Director of Global Health at Children's Health Ireland. So she actually has a position here in Ireland as well. So since relocating to Tanzania in 2007, she has been instrumental in developing childhood cancer services and the National Children's Cancer Network. Dr. Scanlon's contribution have been widely recognized. She's earned several prestigious awards from UCD, the National Cancer Institute's Direct to Lifetime Award, and also local awards in Tanzania as well. And this is the incredible thing. Under her guidance, Tanzania has seen a remarkable improvement in pediatric cancer care. The provision of free chemotherapy, amongst other policies that she introduced, has increased their long-term survival rate from less than 10% in 2016 to over 50% in 2022. And wow, that's all due to her work. She has provided the access to treatment for children there has increased eightfold since she went there. She also displays amazing personal resilience that is equally inspiring. She has twice overcome breast cancer, with December 2022 marking a decade since her first diagnosis. Her unwavering commitment to childhood cancer care in Tanzania and globally embodies a true blend of professional excellence and personal courage.
Wow. I am so excited to listen to this one.
So let's have a listen. Trish, thank you so much for coming on the Baby Tribe podcast. We really appreciate you coming on the show. I'm sure our listeners would be very interested to hear your story. You've done a lot of amazing work. so far in your life, and we'd love to hear about it. So could you share with us what inspired you to actually specialize in oncology and then move to Tanzania?
Well, I think the oncology came just randomly because of the jobs I was assigned as a very junior doctor. And one of the first specializations I came into was oncology, and I loved it. And I always thought that I wanted to work in resource limited settings. So I kind of thought that oncology wouldn't fit. So I was thinking about infectious diseases, but then I realized how many people were involved in infectious diseases, and no one was involved in oncology back in those days, that I actually said, well, actually, maybe this is the thing for me. So yeah, that was where oncology and then pediatric oncology in resource limited settings all kind of came together.
You going over there had a major impact on survival of children that had cancer. Tell us a little bit about that. And what was the scene before you arrived, and what were you able to actually do over there?
So the reason I went was because of a master's program that I was doing in international health. And I went to look at the survival of children. And it was back, I went in 2006. So this was prior to that. And I went to a small hospital, but it was the only cancer hospital in Tanzania. And it had a very small, very basic children's ward. And what I found there was one doctor and three nurses and lots of children. There were drugs for one condition. And what they had done in the 3 years that they had gotten the drugs for that one condition was amazing. They had moved survival from less than 10% to more than 70% by themselves. And so for me, that was the proof of concept. For all the others, there was such a lack of resources, even though the government was very supportive and anything they had was given for free. But there was so little that it meant that almost every other child really had no chance. And it also meant, as this was only one centre in a very vast country, that most children didn't even get to that centre with its limited resources. So kind of the combination of they had done so well with one condition themselves, and what they needed was an advocate, someone who maybe, and what I realised was they needed someone who knew a little about supportive care, who knew about how to move the dial forward for oncology for children, and who wasn't afraid to shout and roar for donors and for just awareness.
Yeah.
And I kind of realised, oh, maybe I have those skills that they need. And so that was why I felt that I was a good fit there. I meant to stay for a couple of years, but it just worked out that every time we came to a brick wall, someone wanted to help us. So we had survival originally, other than that one condition of less than 10%, and about just over 100 children coming to that centre. And then last year, we looked after 1,000 children across 12 sites, and our survival is more than 50%. So nowhere near where it should be. If you compare it to Ireland, for example, where the survival is 85-90% and every child gets care, and still, unfortunately, only about 25% of the children are coming, but vastly different from where it was like 15, 16 years ago.
Yeah, and it's amazing. And how long have you been there now?
I went first in 2006. Okay. And I moved there in 2007. So I've been there since 2007.
Okay, so a long time. And you've really, I mean, it's such a huge impact that you've had and what you've introduced there. It's amazing. We're going to talk about that a little bit more, but I want to pivot over to the common types of childhood cancers. I'm sure a lot of parents and families aren't probably aware mm-hmm. of what those are. So could you enlighten us about the most prevalent childhood cancers, their typical signs and symptoms? And finally, you've alluded to that already, the survival rate. I think people don't realize how good childhood cancer outcomes can be.
So if I start with the early warning signs of childhood cancer, and what I'm going to describe isn't if your child has this, your child has cancer, but these are things to just watch for and see, do they disappear? See, are they evolving? And if they do, then even if it's not cancer, it's probably something your doctor should know about. And I came up with what I think is a useful, it's called helpful, mnemonic for early warning signs for childhood cancer. So H is for unexplained hemorrhage or headaches that go on and get worse, particularly if they're in the morning. E is new eye signs, so a new squint, or if they've got like a white pupil that just suddenly appears, that kind of thing. L is for lumps. These are ones that don't go away and that may slowly, sometimes they grow fast, but most of them they grow slowly and most of them are painless. H-E-L-P is for pain or pallor. And again, the pain is kind of an unexplained pain, usually bone pain, where children shouldn't have bone pain. Children shouldn't have back pain. They don't know they have a back, right? So if they're complaining of back pain, there's something wrong. It may not be cancer, but it's something. L is for H-E-L-P-F-F, sorry.
That's okay.
I wish I could spell. F is for fever or fits. And again, children get loads of fevers, but this is a fever that is continuing and continuing, maybe associated with drenching night sweats, something that you know is not right. You as parents know yourselves, this isn't a normal fever. And then fits or convulsions, again, it may not be cancer, but obviously if your child has a fever or has a convulsion, it's something you should talk to your doctor. It may be a simple febrile convulsion, or it may be something like epilepsy, but there's also a chance it's cancer. U is for unusual signs, like if you have regressed milestones or unusual vomiting or nausea. You know, again, children shouldn't really have intractable nausea or vomiting.
And then, when we say intractable, this is vomiting that just won't stop.
That's right.
Yeah.
And not associated with the diarrhea, yeah, or not associated with a fever, you know, something that you just can't explain it. And it's over weeks usually. So, you know, every child vomits occasionally. And then the final L is for limp. So a child who limps, if you can't explain it, obviously if they get kicked in the knee, we're not talking about those children, but children who have an unexplained kind of something wrong with their leg that you can't explain.
Yeah.
So that's most of the signs.
And again, just to contextualize all of these things, as you said, a lot of these things in isolation can be very common, can be part of other things. One thing that I get asked to review all the time are lymph nodes behind the ears, mm-hmm, you know, in the neck. Sometimes mm-hmm those can be very common, especially in younger kids that could, yes, have ear infections and things like that.
So what I'm talking about are those masses that don't, so they come and go if they're normal. So they might be there for a couple of weeks, but then, yeah, they'll disappear. And also these ones are kind of marching along, slowly growing and growing,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
rather than up one day, down the next. That's not cancer.
Yeah, perfect. And then what are the most common cancers?
So in Ireland, it's the group of tumours together that are brain tumours. But that's a diverse group. But together, they are the number one. And number two then would be the blood cancers or leukemias.
Yeah.
And then there's other ones like lymphomas, as you said, where they have swollen glands in their neck and things like that. Kidney tumours, it's called a nephroblastoma, but it's, yeah, a kidney tumour that the little ones get. And then eye cancers in the little ones.
Yeah.
And that's very similar in Tanzania. What's interesting, though, is we don't see that many brain tumours. But I believe, I may be wrong, but I believe that part of that is because you have to have a scan to diagnose a brain tumour. And because so many of the children live in villages and live in very remote parts of the country with very little access to healthcare, it's called something else. It's called, you know, cerebral malaria, or it's called a seizure syndrome, where actually it might be something,
yeah,
else.
Like, yeah, cancer. And finally, just to emphasize as well, the survival rates have dramatically improved over the last decade or so. Isn't that right?
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, over the last 6 or 7 decades, when in the 1930s or 40s, if you couldn't cut the tumor out, you would die.
Yeah.
And there's been an absolute paradigm shift in that. So today, the vast, vast majority of children who get cancer not only survive, but go on to live long and happy and healthy lives.
Yeah.
There may be some, you know, long term side effects that some children have to manage, but an awful lot of children just put their cancer behind them and just go back to healthy living, which is amazing. We're at, Crumlin has done an amazing job, really an amazing job. And they are, the survival of children there is like 85% across the board. And for some tumours, it's 95%. Yeah. So although it is terribly scary, and I accept that I've had cancer myself, so I know how scary a diagnosis is and being on the other side. But it's also important to know that, you know, there is light at the end of the tunnel. The treatment is amazing.
Yeah.
The supports around your child in CHI Crumlin are amazing as well. The social supports, the play and the therapy that the children have that's not medical is also really wonderful.
You've reported an amazing improvement in outcome in childhood cancer in Tanzania in terms of going up from 10% up to, you know, 60-65%. You've alluded to some of this already, but what was the approach that you employed to achieve this remarkable improvement, and what lessons can we learn for the Irish healthcare system?
So when I went first, I didn't have an organization behind me. I didn't have any money behind me. But what I did first of all, and what we did as a group, because that was what was really important. I was one person, but everybody, the one wonderful thing was everybody on the ward, even though it was a tiny team, wanted to change. They really wanted things to be better. And we looked around at the things that we could change without costing anything. Like when I went first, they were doing a ward round once a week. We changed that to eventually doing it twice a day. Costs nothing, but it picks up a lot of things that are changing before your eyes, and that, you know, saves children's lives. You know, making sure that children get blood transfusions when they need, simple things, acting on fevers, all of that cost nothing. The drugs were available, the blood products were more or less available. And so that was what we did first. But then what I realized was the children weren't coming back because they were being asked to pay for the chemo. So a very large part of the success is one day on the ward, I just announced that chemo was free for every child with no money to pay for it. And I think that's the other lesson I learned is I had no money to pay for it. In the first 3, 4, 5 months, I racked up a bill of $50,000 and I had no way of paying for it. Like I didn't. I'm not wealthy enough to be able to do something like that. But the children started getting better. And then people who were visiting, you know, because people used to pop in and they would say, oh, what's changed here? There's a new atmosphere. And I would say, well, we've given the kids the chemo and they're getting better and they're surviving now. And then they would say, how can we help? So we kind of did it in reverse. We took a gamble and we proved that it worked. And then people got behind us to the point now that we pay for the chemotherapy for every child. When I say we, the charity that I run pays for the chemotherapy for every child in the country, in Tanzania. And we have to raise $1.5 million every year, which we do successfully. But it wouldn't have happened if we weren't brave and brave enough to do what the children needed and worry about the funding afterwards. I'm not sure how that reflects and how that's possible in the Irish system. But there are certain aspects of it that,
it brings up a very important point in that a lot of the time we can be way too careful in either implementing a change, overthinking the potential implications of that change, so much so that we grind to a halt. And I remember hearing at the beginning of the COVID pandemic, the head of the World Health Organization, his name escapes me, he's an Irish gentleman.
Oh, I know who you mean. I can't think of his name either. Yeah.
I remember what he said was, if you strive for perfection in your action, you are going to suffer the consequences of that. I'm paraphrasing here. Mm. But he said, overthinking it, just do it. Just absolutely do it. And sometimes we could do with some of that, just do it here in the Irish healthcare system, I think.
Yeah. Well, right. I've never been accused of being too cautious.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there needs to be a balance as well. That's definitely
true. But it shows. And on that, what were the most significant challenges that you faced and how did you overcome them?
I think at the beginning, everything was a challenge and it was almost overwhelming. And I think the way that I tried and we tried, it's definitely a we here, not an I, we tried to fix it was fix the things that were within our reach that needed to be fixed. And then also what's the thing that's most important that maybe we can't necessarily or we can't find a way through and then work on it. And what we also did was you'd push multiple doors at the same time so that you might say, oh, well, I want to move the children from one hospital to another. And that's the most important thing. But maybe that doesn't happen. But at the same time, you are able to access better diagnostics somehow. And so it's not to have a fixed plan on what direction you're going to go and in which order you're going to solve all these issues is go with what's the next easiest thing to fix. And I think that was what we did. And I think the other thing that I realized was the person or the group that's the most successful doesn't necessarily have the most money, doesn't necessarily have the most influence or contact, but it's the one that just doesn't go away. So, you know, we'd be told, and I think for a lot of people, one of the lessons we had was just don't give up and don't take no for an answer. Don't be mad about it, but just be there and just never go away, because eventually people will get tired of seeing you and will just allow you through. So that was a big thing for me, was just realize that when I tried to do something new, every single time we failed. Step one, fail. And you just realize that's one of the steps in success. And I think that was something I didn't know at the beginning. And I feared, because you thought, well, if I fail, then that donor won't come back. But once you reassure them and say, OK, this won't work the first time we do it, but we'll learn a lot of lessons, and then we can move forward. So there was a lot of things like that that I thought were really, really important.
Yeah, I think people respect that as well when you're honest about your exploratory journey.
I think that's 100% if you've, and it's one of the things that we've had to do when we make mistakes. And we have done, there was a mistake we made about ordering chemo at one point and the expiry date was wrong. But we went to the donor and we said, we are so sorry, we overordered, and this chemo is now, we're giving it to the adults because we can't use it for the children, but I just wanted you to know this. And then they're like, okay, well, you're not hiding anything from us. We trust you as a group, even though you've made this mistake and, it's, you know, don't do it again. But like, we're still your partner. Do you know what I mean?
Exactly. And that's how you learn from mistakes. Mm. On that, I want to go back to the sort of origins of childhood cancer. I mean, we know that in adulthood cancer, there's a lot of, I suppose, environmental triggers or risk factors that may increase your risk of cancers, such as bowel cancer and things like that. There are some that have a genetic basis. In children, and excuse me if I'm being ignorant in this field, it's mostly down to genetics, in that environmental factors play much less of a part. What I'm trying to get at is there anything you can advise parents to avoid or do, or is that something that is not as applicable in childhood cancers?
So I think you're 100% right to bring this up, because I think, especially, say, for example, for parents of children who have cancer, is it's not your fault. There's nothing you could have done differently. The mechanism for childhood cancer is very different from adult cancers. You know, I have had breast cancer and I got it from my lifestyle. Yes, of course, there's probably a genetic predeterminant, but it's, you know, it's about how much, you know, you sleep and how, you know, what food you eat and whether you smoke and drink and all those things. It's not like that for children. It's, if you think about, a baby goes from one cell to a full baby to a 2-year-old, which is half the height they're going to be for their whole life at 2 years of age. That's exponential growth. And so if any one of those little cells just goes slightly wrong, the next one is more wrong, and so on and so on and so on. So yes, of course, you should be healthy and you shouldn't smoke and you shouldn't drink too much and you should take exercise and all the things that you do to avoid having cancer yourself or having any ill health yourself. But particularly for any parent of a child with cancer, there is nothing that you've done or eaten or exposed that child to cause that cancer. The vast majority of children, as you say, it's just incredibly bad luck. And it's genetics in the sense of a cell has acquired a genetic mutation. There are a subgroup of children who have inherited forms of genetic mutations. The children with retinoblastoma, for example, which is the little eye tumor that the small ones get, that about a third of those children have an inherited form of it. And then the other group of children who get cancer where it's caused by something that we can put our finger on are the children who have virally mediated tumours. Particularly in Tanzania, we have children who have HIV, far, far less than we had. And that's another really big success story. When I got there first, about 5% of the children on the ward had HIV-related malignancies. That's down to less than 1% now because of the, you know, the mother to child treatment has the transmission has just dissolved, which is fantastic.
I think that's a good thing for parents to hear, because often the feelings of guilt can be overwhelming, and it's reassuring at some level, I suppose, to inform parents that those things aren't really determined by anything you may have done. Even during pregnancy, mums can feel guilty. Is it something I ate? Is it something I took? Because a lot of those can present early on in the newborn.
And there's been lots and lots and lots of studies done on this, on a huge population-based studies, and no one has ever found anything related. So, and you know, parents of children with cancer have so much to worry about. That is not something that they need to concern themselves with.
Yeah. And on that, what were the most recent advances in the care of childhood cancer that you can tell us about?
So there's been advances in almost every aspect of childhood cancer, from the diagnostics. An awful lot of times now, children can be diagnosed with a blood test instead of taking a biopsy of the tumor. And that is that's extraordinary, because the pain, you know, often the children would have to be put to sleep. Sometimes, you know, you'd have to have a major operation to get at the tumor. Now, a lot of that can be done with a simple blood test. Like, that's extraordinary.
Yeah.
And it speeds up the access to the diagnosis, which means the children don't get so sick. The treatments themselves are also often dramatically different, or for childhood cancer, because we, like, the childhood version of cancer was kind of the first to have all the successes in survival. And so the backbone of childhood cancer treatment is still the old-fashioned chemo. But the new modern, they're not even chemo, but the new modern drugs that are coming on, they can be targeted to something specific in a particular child. So it's, you know, it's these designer drugs for a child and a particular tumor. And they're much less toxic. They cause a lot less side effects, a lot less long-term effects, late effects. And so all of that is really, you know, helpful for the child. And then they improve survival. So that's why our survival is getting better and better and better all the time. And then there's all the supports as well. You know, at the very beginning of this, it was just give the chemo or give the radiation, you know, or the surgery or whatever. And the family just have to struggle on. But there's more and more, you know, understanding of the supports, understanding of long-term follow-up for the children, understanding that the siblings struggle as well and the supports around that. So I think the kind of the psychosocial support has really improved as well. So there's tons of things that are better.
And I think that's very reassuring to parents that have had the experience or parents that are maybe worried about something like that, that, you know, things are advancing all the time and things are looking better and better all the time.
That's right.
And just before we move on to our next thing that we want to talk about, what advice would you give parents that may have children with cancer or have had that experience?
Well, as we've said, number one, don't blame yourself. It genuinely isn't your fault. I think that's the first thing. And obviously number two is, you know, just treasure every moment that you have, not just with the child who has cancer, but the siblings who are there along for that journey as well. Because they are also, what I realized is that, you know, a child or an individual doesn't get cancer, the whole family gets that cancer.
Yeah.
And so it's really important to mind yourself and mind your, you know, your entire family. And the other thing I would say is to include them. People and children particularly can be afraid to worry their parents, to ask maybe difficult questions or questions that their little minds are worried about because they don't want to frighten their parents. So it's really important to keep really an open mind and to encourage conversations, even around difficult topics, with the children, because what they're thinking might be way worse than what the reality is. And that's kind of one of the most important things, is just keep, you know, keep talking to your child and keep making sure that they feel in a safe place to talk to you as well.
And I suppose that also includes any siblings the affected child may have, be honest with them about what's going on and
yeah.
explain things in simple mm-hmm. plain English, but be honest about it.
Always be honest. Don't be cruel. Obviously, no parent would.
Yeah.
But also, I'm not talking about like being blunt and, you know, saying yeah. things. You know, you can listen to your children and gauge what they're asking and give them the information that they're asking for. It's not that you have to give them, you know, all, you know, black and white and what's going on, but just make sure that they don't have these little worries that they're not able to address and that they feel like they're included in the journey.
Yeah, great. I want to pivot a little bit to what's happening in Gaza at the moment. You and I have, as part of a larger group, have been trying our best to advocate in various ways for this conflict. And we've both spoken about our discomfort about the lack of advocacy that's coming from bigger academic institutions about what's going on, especially when there is this perceived double standard where other conflicts have been, they've been very vocal in other conflicts, yet people tend to be quiet about this one. Do you think it's important, first of all, that these academic institutions say something? And why do you think there is this silence?
Okay, so I think that's a really big and important question. It's true that they spoke up about one other conflict, which was the conflict in Ukraine, which for me, I was so proud of all the institutions that did so. And it kind of felt to me like this was a new age that, you know, we were taking a role on the global stage. And this was something that we all felt so passionately about. That we need to protect civilians and particularly children and healthcare staff. And I was so proud of everybody and 100% behind what they had said. But I don't think it's true that they have spoken about other conflicts. And I think this is one of the problems, because I think the Ukraine issue was pushed from an agenda that came from Europe and from the government rather than, you know, from the very real concern that we all had at the time. And I think the problem is that if we don't have the political I guess, leadership to make these comments that they haven't come down from these health institutions. But I think that the way forward is, rather than saying, oh, we haven't commented on, as we have discussed, the terrible things that are happening in Sudan, the terrible things that have happened in Yemen, the terrible things that have happened in a number of different places, therefore we can't comment on Gaza, then we should pause and say, well, why haven't we commented on those either? And let's do it. So I think for me, that's the important lesson that I'm taking from this, particularly in my role as the interim director of global health for Children's Health Ireland, for Crumlin Temple Street and Tala, is I want to highlight and raise the concerns of each area of conflict in the world, particularly where those conflicts are very clearly represented by Irish health staff. And I do think that we should, you know, be there in solidarity with our Irish, whether they are Irish citizens or just Irish health staff, that we should be there supporting them, because it's a clear violation of international law to target health staff, to target children. You know, it's unimaginable what's happening currently in Gaza. I've told you this, I cry every day, and I have done since the 7th of October for what has been happening. And so I think, rather than say we can't talk about it because we haven't talked about anything else, well, let's talk about everybody. Everybody who is vulnerable and everybody who is being harmed, and where, you know, where international law is clearly being broken. That's not a political message. That's humanitarian. And even I would say, you know, children, I think it's really important. It's not about who's right and who's wrong in a conflict. It's children shouldn't be harmed. And, you know, I would also highlight Israeli children who have been harmed. And not only those who've died, but also those who have, you know, the psychological damage that's being done for generations, you know, that has to be solved if we can only highlight that children shouldn't be harmed in any level.
Yeah. And that extends beyond, as you said, physical harm, because I was actually on a podcast last year with Laura Dowling, where I shared my experience of living through the Gulf War when I was 11, 12. And although thankfully no physical harm came to me, the psychological impact and aftermath of having lived through about 11 months of war still lives with me to this day. And I really feel then for the Israeli and Gazan children and children in conflict. I think that's an underrepresented aspect, is the psychological impact that it can have. Even being a child in Israel, where the sirens go off every day or every other day to run down into shelters.
Horrific.
It's absolutely horrific for a child. Some people do minimize that as something, oh sure, they're just little pipes that are being fired from Gaza. But the psychological impact,
yes,
that they have on citizens, but particularly children, is horrendous. And then moving over to the Gazan side, what's happening there is beyond horrific. People losing family, people seeing. I mean, we only see a snapshot of what's going on, you know, through social media, but actually having to live through that and experience that, the impact of it can't be underestimated, you know, in the long run. And it just perpetuates more hate, doesn't it?
100%. You know that glib phrase, but it's really true. Hurt people hurt people.
Yeah.
You know, and like, there's so much hurt on both sides in that particular conflict, in that particular part of the world, that like, it can't be solved by more hurt. It can't be solved by more violence. And as healthcare professionals, where our entire reason is to care. I mean, we're not politicians, we're not, but we can see what caring can do and how that can change a narrative, you know, even on an individual basis, and how much more than on a national or international basis. So that's why I think we have a powerful voice. I think also because, you know, nurses, doctors, healthcare professionals, I think despite, you know, the beleaguered HSC, I think people respect us as, you know, I would say honest actors, by and large, I would hope anyway, that like, our voice is genuinely not a political voice. Our voice is to represent the vulnerable, and particularly children, and particularly children as we're pediatricians, and particularly our colleagues who are literally going to work to try and keep people alive and dying at work currently. Like, that should never, ever happen. And it's not about whose side you're on. That should just never, ever happen to anybody.
How do we move forward from this? How do you think we can change this going forward?
Well, I would say that's not for us to say. We're not politicians. We're not diplomats. I do think violence is not the way. And my glib answer is putting everybody in a room and telling them they're not eating until they come out with a solution that will work for everybody and locking the door. That's obviously not the answer. But my point is, as bystanders, we saw that, you know, you do eventually, like they did to solve, you know, the violence in the north of Ireland. Everybody had to hold their nose and speak to people that they fundamentally didn't agree with.
Yeah.
On all sides, and terrible things had happened to each other on all sides, and they had to sit down for the good of the country and for the good of the region. And if they can't see that that's important, then the international community has to make it happen. But again, that's a very simplistic, I don't mean to suggest, I know I'm not a politician, but what I do know is you should protect children at all costs and you should protect your health service.
We spoke about the relative silence of academic institutions during this conflict. Do you think it actually matters whether they say something or not? Do you think that that sends a powerful message? Does it help in any way, in your view?
So I didn't realize what advocacy does until I spoke to a friend of mine who works in the Gulf, but he's actually Palestinian. I didn't realize that he was. And he said to me, because some of our Irish European politicians have been quite strong, and he sent me a short video of one of them saying he had spent a little time in Ireland. He was like, I'm so glad I spent some of my training in Ireland. I'm so proud of Ireland. And I was like, why? I mean, we're not achieving anything. And he was like, Trish, a small island nation is standing up to the world and standing by our side. So we're not alone. He was like, not only the Palestinians, but, you know, this part of the world will not forget Ireland because you haven't abandoned us. And for me, that was incredibly powerful because it wasn't achieving anything except maybe giving a glimmer of hope that some people were seeing them. Somebody was seeing that what was happening wasn't right. Yeah. And that the death of all these children and, you know, the collapse of their entire, you know, social, all the buildings, all the homes, all the schools, all the universities, that there's good in the world that says this shouldn't happen. It doesn't matter why, this shouldn't ever happen to anyone.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing. Just to finish up, what message do you want to convey to the world, particularly to parents and families, about the situation in Gaza or for global health in general? So what message would you like parents and whoever's listening to this podcast go away with?
Well, you know, I have a 2.5-year-old little nephew and he is the light of my life. I couldn't love him anymore. And he has definitely helped me through, you know, very dark times watching and looking and feeling helpless about what's going on in Palestine, Israel at the moment. So the first thing I would say is make sure to spend time with your children and hug your children and really appreciate them. I'm sure you all do anyway. But, you know, give them an extra hug tonight because there are families and their parents in Gaza right now who are hugging their children extra tight, but they are in a tent, you know, that's, you know, there's waterlogged tents or they're in broken buildings and there's sirens going off. The same as you said, in Israel, there are sirens going off all night, every night. And then there are families who wish that they could hug their children. And I think we all feel a bit of helplessness. What can we do? But there is always something you can do. Whether it's, you know, whether it's just signing petitions or just being kind in your day and, you know, understanding if someone doesn't have your point of view and just trying to deal with them with compassion rather than, you know, meeting anger with anger or fear with fear. That I think just, you know, just go about your day as best you can and just realize that we're all in this together. And, you know, it's hard at the moment because particularly if you're talking about the situation in Gaza, because there's so little that we can do except raise our voices and make sure that they feel heard.
Yeah. And finally, how can people donate to your charity? Tell us the name of it and how can people do that if they wish to do so?
You mean my Tanzania
yes.
charity?
Yes.
So the charity is called Their Lives Matter in Ireland. In Swahili, it's Tumaini La Maisha, which means A Hope for Life, but they're both TLM. And the website is called www.wearetlm.org. And you just hit the donate button and you can donate once, or you can become what we call a gem club, because obviously anyone who donates monthly, it's give every month. But you're also absolutely precious to us if that's what you'd like to
and,
do.
And you can be absolutely sure that every cent goes towards the children.
So we are, I'm so proud of our organisation. Every cent goes to the children. You know, there's been lots of scandals in Ireland around, you know, charities and things like that. So I can guarantee my salary is the smallest salary of almost any, I would say, CEO of any organisation, any healthcare organisation or any charity organisation. I'm paid €36,000 a year.
Yeah.
So, yeah. To be honest, I think there's no doubt.
I think they're getting their money's worth out of you, in fairness.
Yeah. And
you
know? we pay for the chemotherapy for every child in the country. We pay for transport. We pay for food. We pay for a play therapy program. We pay for some of the doctors, some of the nurses, some of the healthcare staff around. So we do as much as we can to try and make sure there's no bills for the children. So it's a really, really effective charity.
Thank you, Trish. Thank you so much for coming on the Baby Tribe podcast. We really appreciate your time.
That was my pleasure. Thank you for asking.
Thank you for tuning in to today's episode of the Baby Tribe podcast. We're delighted to have shared this time with you, offering guidance and support for your parenting journey.
I've been Afif and she's been Katie, and together we've been your guides in exploring the multifaceted world of parenting. Remember, every step you take in nurturing your child makes a world of difference.
Stay connected with us and don't miss our next episode, where we'll continue to delve into the valuable insights and practical tips for raising healthy and happy children. Thank you for being part of our tribe, and remember, you're doing an amazing job.
This show is part of the Head Stuff Podcast Network, a hub for the creative and the curious. Shows are produced in association with Head Stuff and the Podcast Studios Dublin. Find out more or become a member at headstuffpodcasts.com.